Hey everybody, welcome to the Green Architects Lounge podcast. I'm your host, Chris Briley.
And I'm your host, Phil Kaplan. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Phil. How you doing, man?
I'm doing excellent this evening.
Excellent. It's been a while since we've been on the air.
It's true.
Yeah. So,
what are we going to talk about today, Chris? I know, but softball for you.
Yeah, thanks. Chris. I'm gonna try and hit this one. We are going to talk about Pretty Good House.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people, you know, like the Pretty Good House, it's like a phrase now that's sort of become its own thing, and it's not that well defined out there. Mike Maines has a great blog. You could put it in the search bar up there on Green Building Advice, and you'll get a few hits. But we decided it's time to really talk about this on our podcast, especially because it was in the New York Times, sort of, mm-hmm. with a conversation about Passive House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was really nice that Martin Holliday, our very own Martin Holliday,
was
interviewed by the New York Times and asked about Passive House, and I don't know how Passive House feel about it, but he talked about Passive House, said, "Oh, it's interesting, but you know, not right for
everybody. Maybe not the most cost-effective approach."
But you know what is really good? Have you heard of the Pretty Good House?
Yeah. And that was like a wow. And then you click on Pretty Good House, and then boom, it goes to the greenbuildingadvisor.com thing. And there's Dan Colbert at the blackboard at the main Green Building mm-hmm. Supply, the building science discussion groups that we have here in Maine. So,
but one of the interesting things about the Pretty Good House is that it's got this elusive nature that is really kind of wonderful, that people have talked about it for
right.
a long time, referenced it. John Straub was talking about it when we interviewed him several
right.
episodes ago.
Yeah.
And yet when you look online about Pretty Good House, there's not a lot there yet.
No, that's right. And so in fact, it's non-defined nature and its elusiveness is probably its best asset.
That's right. Are we going to screw that up and define
maybe.
It tonight?
Yeah, probably, but you know.
But we'll, that's one of the things you're working on, isn't it, Chris?
And when we say me, it's like we'll let the cat out of the bag. There's a book in the works. And there's not
very exciting.
There's no one true author. And, you know, it might all fall apart and not happen, but I have a feeling it will. And it's going to pull in a lot of resources and bring in a lot of names of a lot of people that everyone's heard of. And it's going to have a lot of contributors, and no one person's going to get rich off this thing. And no one's going to be, you know, it's going to be one of those books that's going to hopefully hit a lot of shelves and act as a reference and a guide.
It sounds pretty good to me.
All right. Well, I hope so. So,
hey, tell us about this excellent cocktail before we dig in deep. Because I'm drinking something kind of special and something I would have never thought would have tasted this.
You know,
I usually pull that off.
It's because, and I will be honest. This is the first I've tried it.
Mm-hmm.
This is called a revolver, and I think that's because it's supposed to be made with bullet bourbon.
Uh-huh.
But in fact. I was recently given an awesome bottle of Blanton's bourbon. I will give a very honest, holy cow, that is good bourbon.
Agreed.
Yeah, it's from friends who are, dear friends of the family who are from the Louisville, Kentucky area, actually New Orleans.
And they know bourbon.
They do know bourbon, these guys. So. So, you know, I had you try some before we even, you know, it's almost a shame to mix it.
Yeah.
But since I had it and I'm like, I'll feature something like that. So I was looking for good bourbon cocktails and the revolver came up like 3 or 4 times on the old Google machine. Mm-hmm. So let me get right to it. Sorry. It's basically 2 ounces of bourbon, 1/2 ounce of coffee liqueur. We're just using Kahlua, but it recommends Tia Maria. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we got 2 dashes of bitters, we're using the blood orange bitters.
Sterling's blood orange, which
right.
is
and then,
never so tasty.
A little orange zest. And isn't it delicious?
It really is.
Hmm.
Yes. You know, one of the things I really commend you for, Chris, is that the garnishes, the accoutrement, you do not slack off.
No, that's the best part.
Usually I don't even bother with the glass. I put the ingredients in my mouth and shake. But you, the orange zest just right. You've taught me a little class.
Yeah, you got to do the orange zest. It makes a difference. And you wipe it around the rim, people, and then you crimp it, and you put it in the glass. And sometimes they say, don't put it in, but I go ahead and put it in. But
I feel just a little bit fancier. Like I want to hold my pinky up while I drink.
Yeah, well, I don't know. But this, I mean, if I just hand this to you and you close your eyes, you didn't see the thing hanging off of you. You go, man, this is a manly drink.
It is. That's right.
It's dark. It's bourbony. Mm-hmm. It's smoky. It's nice for fall.
It is very kind of fall-like. And the orange zest is sort of a little reference.
And rather strong, too, if I do say so myself.
You do, and I can hear it in your voice.
Yes.
All right, so let's get right to it. So
yeah, I'd love to hear... tell me about the origins of this.
All right, yeah, that's a great start, because... all right, as many of you know, here in Southern Maine, we have Building Science Discussion Group. Every month we get together. I know it sounds boring, but it's not. It really isn't.
It's great. A lot of fun.
It is, because there's no name tags. Most of us know each other by now anyway. We're all building professionals. And honestly, there's no clients there. So we're allowed to make mistakes. We're allowed to like ridicule each other and tease each other. And it's a great atmosphere, and there's food, and there's booze, and if clients come, hey, they're warned, you know. This is not, you know, I've had Roger Norman there, you know, he's That's a client right. of mine. As soon as you got an architect, he's like, I know exactly what the, no. The second you think you know something, that's when life hands you humble pie.
That's right.
And then you eat it, and then you move on, so... I've had my share. So anyway, for one of the discussion groups, you know, Dan Colbert, who's a builder, and he's the lead moderator. He is the moderator, and I'm his understudy when he's not there. So everyone's I get to moderate. But he just sort of almost as a joke, you know, he was, you know, imagine a builder frustrated with lead and passive house, and like Martin's comments, you know, like. Passive house is not for everybody. It's like summiting a mountain. Not everyone likes to go all the way to the top of Mount Everest. I mean, or can, you know, and there's a point at which I'm going to diverge a little bit, but like, and I think Roger would be fine with this, but like the passive house that I worked on, you know, we found ourselves like spending about a week tweaking windows. We're looking for 6 BTUs per square foot per year, you know?
Right.
Yeah, so we're, you know, fussing and moving things away, and then Mark Rosenbaum just says, you realize we're talking about the equivalent of $6 a year in kilowatt hours that we're talking about, or maybe I have that wrong, but it was like such a small amount. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, you know, one more solar panel, we could all just shut up and stop paying. For the amount he spent, you know, on consultants muscling out this last little bit, tweaking the design,
right.
could have bought one more panel and done it, and or not done it, but... generated that equivalent amount of energy. Mm-hmm. So it's that point that Martin always makes about passive house is like there's a certain point where you are no longer doing the most cost-effective thing,
right.
but you are doing the purest thing where you are reducing demand. It is the shell, it is energy demand, and that's what passive house is about, not generation. All right, small divergence. So imagine Dan... Mm-hmm. You know, doing lead. His house is that we're talking about is way greener than a lead whatever house. You know,
right.
It's just ultra green, and just almost feels silly to be working so hard to do the paperwork that you send into lead. I'm not bashing lead, maybe I am, but you know, that it feels
right. There's this crazy rigor to both lead and passive house.
Exactly, and especially when in the case of lead, is it changing your house? Is it my You know, in this case, no, it's not. It's not adding or contributing. Mm-hmm. It's just giving you a third-party certification that...
Right, if you're doing this anyway.
Right. So, you know, at this particular, building science discussion group, he's like, I just want to build a pretty good house, you know? What does a pretty good house look like? And that's really a testament. It's a statement about the status quo. There's a lot of crap out there, Phil. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you go outside our circles.
Yeah, I've smelled it.
Yeah. Woo! Oh man, I mean, you see some of these houses that are being built in some of these subdivisions, and you're like, oh my God.
It's painful. And I want to yell at these people. Don't you realize what you're doing?
Right.
These houses are going to be obsolete in a few years.
And aren't you embarrassed?
Yeah.
No.
Can't you just build,
Right. And it's not like they're intentionally going out. They're building what sells, you know, and that's why they're doing it. And people are buying what's offered, which is that. So So we started this discussion about, well, all right, what should the status quo be? What should a pretty good house be? Right. And it's a bit of a trick because the pretty good house is actually a damn good house.
It's a really good house. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's I remember making the list on the chalkboard and said, what, you know.
Yeah.
What does that mean to be pretty good?
Well, yeah. And it turns out it means to be really darn good. It means to be the most, you know, sort of a cost-effective, bang for the buck, really good. Yeah, you know, smart. I mean, smart.
It's right because pretty good. When I first heard it, you know, it's got this pejorative smack.
Yeah.
To, you know,
when I tell my wife we're writing a book, Pretty Good House, she's like, "Well, that doesn't sound very ambitious at all." I mean, that's pretty. I mean, sitting the bar kind of low, aren't you? I mean, who's going to buy that? Well, you know, it's not even standards. It's really guidelines. You're not when you do a pretty good house, you're not submitting a checklist into some third party for certification. This is a way to get, you know, everybody on board. Imagine a book or a movement that's very similar to Sarah Cizanka's
So Big House.
Exactly, where
the biggest selling book of all time for architecture.
Right, and what a wonderful way to and it's a very simple message, which is quality, not quantity. You know, do you really need all that stuff? Mm-hmm. And if we focus on details and quality, and it's the same thing, only with energy efficiency. Can we do that same thing? And that's what the pretty good house is. So, we're about to take you down the journey about what those guidelines are shaping out to be right now, subject to change as all these experts chime in.
Wonderful. Take me on that journey, Chris. All right. Where does the journey start?
All right. So, imagine... in the end, maybe there is a checklist, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of saying a pretty good house does these things, check, 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 mm-hmm. it's really a pretty good house considers these things. Thermal bridging would be a great example, all right? Mm-hmm. Like a pretty good house takes thermal bridging into consideration and does something about it, mm-hmm. right? And then,
but it doesn't get into the level of rigor per se and quantify
exactly. It doesn't say you have to do this or you have to do that. It's just like, if you're a pretty good house, you're considering that. And so in your checklist, you have like maybe three or four things to check off. Maybe you're wrapping this thing with insulation on the outside. Maybe you're doing double studs, or maybe you're doing horizontal strapping or other. And that's where then you, the builder, the owner, the architect, somebody writes in what you actually are doing. And maybe it's clever and better than all those other things. And maybe it's unique to your project. And aren't you awesome? And you're not submitting that to anyone. You're just... as part of your meetings or something, using that as a guideline as part of the construction process. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, homeowners out there are gonna buy this book, they're gonna read it, they're gonna go to their builder and they're gonna say, I wanna do a pretty good house. And the builder's gonna be like, oh yeah, I know what that is. I've heard of that. And they're gonna be handed this checklist and they're gonna be kind of familiar with it. And they're gonna be like, yeah, we're gonna address all these things and we're gonna do a good house. Pretty good house, a damn good house. But, so let's talk about the guidelines.
Okay.
One, you know, of course, it's going to be design, right, Phil?
Right. So, yeah. I mean, design is such a broad thing.
Right. You're not.
What is a pretty, you know, how do you quantify a pretty good design?
Well, that's the hard part.
Man.
And that's going to be the hard part about every single one of these things. It's like, we're not going to put a, you know, particular thing on it, but you're going to consider things. There are guidelines. For mm-hmm. example, size. All right. Now, if you're, there'll probably be guides in here.
So big is bad, small is good, right?
Pretty much.
Right, but it doesn't quantify. LEED does that,
mm-hmm. but we're not going to penalize you because there's nothing to penalize. Mm-hmm. There's just going to be this conversation that you're going to have about, look, if you're a family of two and you have a 6,000 square foot house, that's not pretty good. That's a little wasteful, mm-hmm. to be honest.
Yeah.
And if that's not for you, you're going to kind of skip over this section, but it's going to be there in sort of the, you know, red mark. Everyone's going to, you know,
right.
That's just, a pretty good house is not going to do that. A pretty
like
good house.
A responsible professional who talks about pretty good house is going to talk about these things on this design right. checklist.
Are you a family?
Yeah, I'm starting to learn here.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so there'll be a chapter in the book, or you know, size is going to be one of those things. Same with shape and orientation. There's going to be a little quick, you know, primer about orienting towards the stuff we've talked about many times on this mm-hmm. podcast. Mm-hmm. Orienting to the south, mm-hmm. You know, sheltering, you know, from the you know, prevailing breezes, and you know, you put your living spaces to the south, put your support spaces to the north, you know, glazing, that sort of thing. Complexity, you know, keeping your house simple, not doing all the overly expensive things. It's not to say you can or can't. It's just like a pretty good house is gonna recognize complexity as, you know, not necessarily waste, but you know, something that there's a premium for.
Right. You're making a very clear judgment on a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Complexity is not where you what you want to strive for. Period.
Exactly.
Like, all right, well, I like the look with lots of dormers. I'm sorry, you can have whatever you want, but that's not really what the pretty good house is all about.
Right. There may be a dormer, maybe a couple of dormers. I mean, you know, it might be, you know, it's like, let's, you know, you're considering this thing as in terms of how complex. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there'll be guidelines about the complexity of your house and keeping things simple. Mm-hmm. Likewise, having an integrated design process, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we've talked about that. Lead talks about that.
That's right. Bringing everybody on the team on board early and together.
Right. And having all trades in mind while you're moving forward. You can't just like plop things in at the last minute and expect it to go smoothly because, you know, someone's going to have to move a beam to make room for something else.
That's right. So. Consider everything.
Right. And then, of course, one of the things that you're going to do in design, this is, you know, a pretty good house is actually going to do an energy. Yeah. It'll be fine.
That should work.
We'll
right.
put a boiler in there and it'll take care of it. No mm-hmm. worries. You know, what are your energy bills going to be?
Eh.
I don't know. Yeah, about, you know, whatever. No, we're going to have a pretty good idea. And honestly, you know, you and I do it all the time, but, and it makes sense to us, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we're doing the, you know, a lot of times we're doing Energy Star. Mm-hmm. We're doing inspections along the way. It's part of what we do. It's mm-hmm. actually part of design in the beginning, and a pretty good house is going to do that. And then, of course, with the design part, yours and my favorite topic mm-hmm. when it comes to green design is beauty mm-hmm. and aesthetics. Because, let's be honest, an ugly house is not going to last long. Someone's going to mm-hmm. knock it down. There's a reason why all the beauty, you know, you go to these old towns in Europe and you're like, oh man, every single one of these buildings is gorgeous. That's because over 1,000 years, the crap gets torn down and the gorgeous things stay.
Right.
So
doesn't matter how energy efficient it is, really.
Exactly.
If it's an eyesore, nobody wants to be near that house, much less in it.
Right. And likewise, if it's really not energy efficient, mm-hmm. but yeah, it's still beautiful and everyone loves it and functional, it stays and becomes a burden that way.
Well, one of the other certification systems that's out there is Living Building Challenge.
Yeah.
And for a while, they have a pedal right. about beauty.
Yeah.
You know, and for a while, I questioned that. I was like, well, how are you going to quantify that? But the truth is, it doesn't matter. Again, they've opened up the conversation. I really, really respect that. And they make people think about it and empowers designers to put that on the table.
It's important.
It's so huge. Yeah. It's so huge. And, you know, if anything, it's such a critical part of the heart of Pretty Good House, because you can never quantify beauty.
No.
You're not going to try to pin it down, but you kind of know it when you see it.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the real design part with a capital D, to make sure that it's thought out and not slapdash together. So another big component is climate. You have to know the climate of your house. I mean, so many homeowners and builders, there's a ton of builders who don't even know what climate they're in.
So you're saying that Pretty Good House is going to vary based on the climate that you're in.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Which means I can't write this thing, right? I'm Mr. Cold Climate.
Right.
I need people from the south. We need some. There's gonna be guidelines for every zone, mm-hmm. and it's not like there's anything new in this book or this concept or whatever. It's sort of like the way it's assembled. It's almost like the Seinfeld episode. This you know, Pretty Good House is about nothing new.
Have you thought maybe your wife is right, Chris?
Yeah. That always happens. just when my ego is, so for every climate there's gonna be a little bit of some guidelines in terms of what you should be aiming for in terms of, you know, how we talked about the 10, 20, 40, 60 and you know, many times
we've talked about. We had somebody write us from Costa Rica at one point. Like,
that's right.
Boy, we are absolutely telling you the wrong thing.
Right, exactly. So, exactly. What do we do for you in Costa Rica?
Well. But please tell us what you do so we can include you as a you're going to include these guys as a co-author?
Exactly. Yeah, well, maybe. We'll see. and then, of course, we're in the climate chapter, or in the subject of climate, we've talked about at the Building Science Discussion Group is climate change. You know, are we going to be? Does a pretty good house consider our changing climate and what we're going to be faced with the future? For example, for us here in the north, we don't have termites in Maine, but
they're moving up this way.
Are we gonna?
Yeah,
probably. We're probably going to have them.
Yeah.
That's going to be a problem for a lot of the houses that are here, that we've built without regard to that, insulation that's just buried and not protected. And won't that be curious?
Yeah, it'll be a big eye-opener.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then we're going to have a subject of, regarding the building envelope. And that's going to be a big, and that'll probably be a... There's lots to talk about there, and that in and of itself is a podcast, but there's basic subjects like insulation fill. Like a pretty good house is probably going to follow the same 10, 20, 40, 60 rules with some very, become less critical as you get warmer, probably.
Yeah, so that seems like a good guideline. Well, one of the things I'm interested in, Chris, because we had this conversation, and there are some passive house folks out in the audience, and you're one of them too. I mean, I can't say I'm not either. I kind of have a foot in multiple camps, but we're doing them as well. But I wonder where our limits are. And if you ask, boy, if passive house instead of our 40 walls, are you up to our 60 walls? Are 70 walls? Are 120 in the roof?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like a guideline thing, and it's not going to be right for everybody to do any one particular. To say it must be R60, and you have like an R58. Do you fail? No, no. You did good for what was right for you and your climate and your owner and all that. I mean, it's sort of like what we're trying to do is elevate that conversation. But interesting. I mean, to that, we had a lot of people, sort of in the passive house camp saying, why are you setting, a low bar? I mean, in that, why aren't you? The bar should always be just as high as it can be, and you should always be striving for that.
Right, because that's really what pushes people. It's what pushes the envelope further. When you strive to hit 180, maybe you'll hit 120.
Well, exactly.
And you're starting at 60.
And and that was Jesse's point when we were talking about that at the Nessie Forum was like people always feel like they have to, they choose the middle. If they're choosing the highest part, then they're being the ones who are out there on the cutting edge and all that. And some people, spend more because at least they're not getting the, $24 lobster.
That's right. People like the second most expensive thing on the menu, and they'll never order the first most expensive.
Exactly. Exactly right. So, in a way, the pretty good house is what it's really doing is it's setting that higher bar. It's like recognizing the status quo right now is really low. I mean, and that's kind of what we talked about the Building Science Discussion Group is like. You leave our circles, you go out into what's...
Right, and there's a lot of production housing in different parts of the country, and even in the Northeast for sure.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of it is meets code, maybe, and which means they're just not breaking the law,
And, the killer is that this is not affordable housing that we're talking about.
No, we're talking about,
standard, what most people consider high-quality houses.
Right. Market rate, custom home design. Well, I say custom, it gets a little crazy, but just a market rate, newly built home. I'll finish up envelope, and then we'll take a break and come back. But, with the envelope, of course, there's insulation, Then there's air sealing. We'll have standards for air sealing and guidelines. See, I'm saying standards, guidelines for air sealing. We, you know, Passive House, I think one good thing that Passive House has really been good for is really elevating that as mm-hmm. by having a standard for that of mm-hmm. 0.6 air changes per hour. It's at ACH 50. It's really gotten a lot of builders and local people here, mm-hmm. you know, to really start buckling down and trying to at least come close to that. So there'll be guidelines in there.
Yeah, and what is that? I remember having this conversation specifically, and I remember saying throwing out either 1.5 ACH 50 or 1.0 ACH 50.
Right. Well, interesting enough, I think the Maine Housing Authority, or Maine Housing they're called now, you know, they had, if you had 2.5 mm-hmm. air changes per hour at ACH 50, then you had to have an ERV. And you know, to you and I, that's almost humorous. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. you know, so it was like an indoor air quality measure.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, if you're going to have your house that tight, then you're going to be. And so I think you and I before we'd said, and I think in the building science discussion group, they said, yeah, 1.5 mm-hmm. is a great number that we mm-hmm. should all be shooting for. Shoot for one, you know, and if you get 1.5, feel good about yourself.
Right. Every single builder that we've introduced this to try to do just a tight, super insulated home, they've all hit 1.5.
Yeah, it's like it's not, it's almost like an awakening where I think when builders soak it in and they decide we're gonna try and do this, we're gonna try and build this thing tight, their numbers are amazingly different, and what a difference it makes in the house and the energy performance. I mean, you put that in the model and bam, huge difference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, go builders. Thermal bridging, like I mentioned, you know, if you can minimize the conductivity through your envelope, hey, that's a guiding principle that you're gonna have to do. You know, a pretty good house is going to actually consider that. So many of these houses out there, they don't throw in bridging. You know, what's that? You know, oh yeah, we'll insulate the headers. You know, done.
Right.
And there's more to it than
that. It's not enough.
No. Try it. You know, you're going to have to wrap the outside, or you're going to have to, you know, we've talked about that before. You know, offset, you know, do some double studs, do some horizontal strapping on the inside, or something else clever.
And I really just think you're on the right track with this. And I think once builders see this and are aware of it, I think it's going to be a matter of pride.
Mm-hmm.
I know Paul Eldrenkamp has been a big advocate.
Yeah.
And we're grateful to have Paul's backing. He's just a wonderful builder and really respect the guy. But when we had the Pretty Good House presentation at the NESE annual meeting last year, that was his point.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great builders out there, and it's a matter of pride. They want to do the right thing.
They do.
You've got to show them what the right thing is, and they're going to figure it out.
Yeah, and as much as we, you know, we bash builders every once in a while. I mean, they bash us, you know, 10 times more than that. But we have some of the best builders in the world here in Maine. I mean, in New England. I mean, we, honestly, they are top-notch. Great,
mm-hmm.
stubborn as hell. Damn Yankees, man.
That's right.
Thank God.
Because they've been doing it the right way for 30 years.
Yeah, generations.
Right. So,
but boy, once they learn that new way, then that is the thing.
That's the thing.
Then they'll be stubborn on that. And so,
that's right.
And then one more thing about the envelope, and we'll take a break, is, you know, there's also the roof, you know, and there's and radiant barriers and you know, reflectivities of the roof. It's less important. You know, that's a climate thing.
Mm-hmm.
For us, you know, the heat island effect here in Maine, not a big deal. In Atlanta, big deal.
Big deal, right.
Yeah. You know, San Antonio, yeah.
Goes back to your concentrating on the climate.
Right. So a lot of this is going to matter to you. It's not going to matter to us. And you know, that's one disadvantage that LEED tends to have. So you ready to take a break? Let's refresh these cocktails and get back to this.
Sounds good.
All right.
That's it for this part of the episode. Be sure to tune in next week for more from the Green Architects Lounge podcast. A quick reminder that our theme music is Zelda's theme from Perez Prado, and that the views and drinking habits of the hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Green Building Advisor. Thanks for tuning in, everyone, and keep up the good work.